All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and you're not. You know, I got to stop doing that routine. I don't know what got into me. It's just kind of overcomes me. Every time I get near a microphone, I've got to do that old Chevy Chase routine from Saturday Night Live, and I don't know why. Anyway, this is a very special show today, and I'm really glad that we're getting a chance to air this, to talk with you about all this. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with attorney Gary Blasi. Gary's a professor emeritus at UCLA Law School and a longtime advocate for the homeless in Los Angeles. And we'll be talking with him about El Nino and its potentially deadly impact on people living on the streets in Los Angeles. And this is something that I don't care where you live, you got to pay some attention to this one. Before that, we'll be talking with Larry Everest, writer for Revolution Newspaper and RevCom.us. And he's also the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. We're going to be discussing the outrage in San Bernardino, why things like this happen, and what we should be doing about it, and why we definitely should not be rooting for our own rulers. And before that, we'll be talking with Josh Willis, climatologist and oceanographer with NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. And we'll be talking about another side of El Nino. He'll be talking about what it is and the impact it may have on people around the world. This is something that doesn't get nearly enough attention these days, and I'm really looking forward to this discussion. But opening the show up, there's a couple of things I want to do first. Now, first, I want to let you know what's been going on with the trial of the freedom fighters who stood up against the murder by police on April 14th and were arrested and have been hauled into trial. There's 10 of them that have been singled out to actually stand trial for the crime of protesting police murder. And meanwhile, what's going on with the police? They aren't facing trial. They aren't facing this. And we've seen what's even happened in Chicago. We got a sense of how when you unwind, when you start to pull at that little thread, suddenly the emperor is standing naked. And a lot of the stuff that they claim is the way things are actually revealed to be really the way things are. And they're pretty damn screwed up. And so I wanted to let people know that the first group of three people who were on trial down in the LA courts, they were convicted on the charges they faced. And they got lengthy periods of probation and community service. They also have been fined thousands of dollars that they need to pay in court costs. It's an incredible slap in the face, an incredible hit at the movement. It's meant to terrorize everybody else who's thinking about the need to stand up against all this. And these people need our support. And they're part of a group. There's still seven other people who are facing equally serious charges. The prosecutor in the case is this incredibly brutal. And she's Jennifer Waxler. She's the city attorney's political prosecutor, and she's going after as many people as she can who have been speaking out and standing up against murder by the police in the last year and a half. There are still seven more freedom fighters who stood up against murder by police facing trial. They recently had a hearing, and their cases were continued to January 11th. On December 9th, four UCLA students were also brought into court. These were people who were arrested for courageously blocking an entrance to the 405 freeway on April 14th, 2015, as the part of the National Day of Protest. And their case was also continued until early next year. And on December 8th, there was a trial began for Patty Beers, the live streamer who was arrested as part of the outrageous mass arrest carried out by the LAPD last November in the wake of the non-indictment of the police who murdered Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. So we need to be paying attention to all this. The question is posed for all of you. Which side are you on? I want to encourage people to really wrestle with this, to really, you know, show. Just not just really show. Don't tolerate this and show it, okay? That's important.
You can go to riseupoctober.org or stopmassincarceration.net, and there you're going to find a statement of support. It's right to protest murder by police for you to read, check out, and sign if you're moved to do so.
Now, Teddy, I want to do one thing here real quick, man. Let's play that Johnny Lobo song because let me intro it first, all right? And then just play. We'll play. I'll let you know when we'll go out on it. I just want people to think a little bit about this, all right? I want people to think about this. I want them to think about this very seriously. This is a song from Kris Kristofferson. It's called Johnny Lobo, and it's about John Trudell. John Trudell was a fighter against the oppression of indigenous people. He was a fighter against all the savage crimes that U.S. imperialism commits across the world. And he was in D.C., and he was protesting for indigenous rights, and he burned an American flag on the steps of the FBI building. The next day, his home, with his mother, his mother-in-law, his wife, and his three children, was burnt. They were all killed. Now, no one ever proved who did it, but John Trudell always believed that the system had a hand in it, and there was a lot of things pointing that way. And after all, you know, the FBI was, they weren't doing much. A wounded knee, can we talk about that? Can we talk about all the ways that they had set people up? So John Trudell, who was someone who always stood on the side of the people, And so I want you to listen to this song from Kris Kristofferson. It's Johnny Lobo, and we'll play it just a little out.
Once upon a dusty reservation, somewhere in the land of Sitting Bull, Johnny Lobo played with fire and dreamed of open spaces, locked inside a heaven gone to hell. All the dreams were gone but not forgotten, murdered like the holy buffalo. Johnny Lobo knew the rules and grew into a warrior, fighting for his people and his soul.
All right, Johnny Lobo by Kris Kristofferson. And you can find that on the album Moment of Forever. All right, a beautiful song. And important to remember, people like John Trudell. All right, I'm really pleased to welcome to the show a man who is sitting across from me and he's breathing heavy, okay? it's because he's got so much to say, all right? And his name is Josh Willis. He's a climatologist and oceanographer with NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And we're going to be talking about El Nino, what it is, and the impact it may have on people around the world, and a couple of other questions, my friend. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Michael.
Sure. Let me, real quick, let's just jump into it. El Nino. What the hell is it? And why is it so significant?
Well, El Nino is a massive movement of warm water in the Pacific Ocean. That's really all it is. There's a bunch of warm water that's usually way over in the West Pacific near Indonesia and Australia. And during an El Nino, all of it slides across the equator and winds up warming the waters off of South America and in the Central Pacific, too. And the reason that's important is because it wreaks havoc with weather all over the world.
Okay, you've got all these metaphors in there, a blob, a glob.
Right.
And it slides across.
Godzilla.
Yeah. Right. Or just like a big slug.
Right. I like a slug, yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, one of the things that has always gotten me, in fact, where I heard about you was in an article that appeared in the LA Times. And then as we did research, I said, why the hell did I know about this guy before? I have you on more often, man, especially because of what's going on in the ocean. But, you know, in California, there's a tendency to sort of see El Nino broadly in society as sort of like, hey, you know, it's like, you know, they showed pictures of the ski resorts with snow and people
right.
Like, hey, it's good for us. Or the idea that, well, this may take care of the drought. And we tend to forget, actually, there's a massive impact that this has on the rest of the world. So I wanted to ask you about this. Actually, when you're looking at it, you know, it has immense repercussions, I think, in the entire world. And even here, in a sense of what it actually is bringing about. It's not just about skiing and ending the drought.
Right. That's absolutely right. Indonesia and Northern Australia, to start kind of remotely, have been suffering punishing drought because of this El Nino. The rain that they normally get that's really important for them, they get a lot of rain, hasn't happened this year because it's followed the warm water across the Pacific and landed elsewhere. In places in South America, they're having incredible flooding already. The hurricane season in the eastern Pacific was incredibly active. We even had a few travel right across Mexico and leave little storms across the central part of the U.S. So it really changes the weather patterns an enormous amount. And the thing about El Nino in Southern California in particular is that it tends to just bring huge amounts of rain over the course of our winter. And so we're probably going to see flooding. We're going to see mudslides. We're going to see more rain than we can handle. The beaches get really messy because of our brilliant system for saving us from flooding. Also collects all of our trash and dumps it in the ocean. So there's a huge amount of impacts. Some of them are good. Yes, we're going to get more rain. Hopefully we'll get more snowpack too. We really need it, but it's a mixed blessing.
Yeah, and one of the things, I mean, you know, and I understand that, and I think it's important in terms of this point about mixed blessing. But one of the things as I was reading, and I have to tell you the truth, I never, you know, I was looking through Mike Davis's book on how the third world was actually formed and its relationship to climate, you know,
yeah.
and how that developed. And it's a very heavy scene because you don't really think about that. And one of the points that was made to me in somewhere was they talked about Ethiopia is going to be one of the hardest hit places. And Ethiopia already has millions of people on the edge of death from starvation.
That's right. Yeah. Rainfall patterns in the tropics all the way around the planet are affected by a big El Nino. And this is the biggest one we've had since the turn of the millennium, and probably the biggest in 50 years or more. So it's a huge event, and it's disrupting weather all around. Some places get crazy floods, some places get huge drought. It's a mixed bag, but everything is upside down.
What about, I'll go throw some things at you. Okay.
All right.
What about wildfires? This is kind of heavy because, you know, again, El Nino, you don't always, you know, that spontaneously it's not like, well, wildfires. I mean, when you're looking at what's happening in the rest of the world, this is pretty damn incredible when you're talking about all these wildfires bursting up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, places that have had drought for long periods, like here in Southern California, you know, we've been incredibly prone to wildfires already. And right now we're just about to get into the rainy season. And so hopefully we will have dodged some of that bullet this year. But other places, you know, I mentioned Indonesia and things, they're really getting wildfires, really dry conditions, and they're powder kegs.
What about the jet stream? I was really curious about that. You know, and of course, my limited knowledge, I'm like, the jet stream, whoa, planes are going to be pushed out.
Sounds pretty big.
Right, what's going on there?
Right. Well, the jet stream normally comes from west to east across the Pacific. And it sort of usually dodges a little bit south and brings most of these storms to Central America and Mexico. What happens during El Nino is it gets pushed north and it hammers us with all the storms that normally would move a little further south. So we're likely in the southern half of the United States and northern half of Mexico, we're going to get a lot more rain than we're used to. Mm-hmm. And that's because it's the rain arrives on the jet stream. It's our conveyor belt for storms.
Great. They get a plane ticket. I don't.
Exactly.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Josh Willis. Josh is a climatologist and oceanographer with NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and we're talking about El Nino and the devastating impact it may have on people all around the world.
But here's a question, because it's very heavy, because I think about this even in a sense when you're saying, like, okay, it's coming up here. And you know, one of the things that worries me is, like, you know, that lunatic Edward Teller, who was the, you know, the model for the Dr. Strangelove, you know?
Right.
And who actually really wanted to blow up most of the world.
Wow.
But he used to argue when they were talking about nuclear winter, he would say, well, I'm currently working on a project to see if we can confine the impact of nuclear winter to the Soviet Union, their bloc, and the third world. So, you know.
Right. Well, weather has always been the ultimate weapon that human beings want to figure out how to harness. But so far, it's still too big for us to handle. We don't know really how to control the weather, apart from maybe detonating huge numbers of nuclear weapons. And, you know, that would be a problem anyway.
Yeah, you think?
Right.
Well, you know, have you tried reaching out to Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
I have them on speed dial, Michael.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. I'm looking forward to that. Well, one of the things, actually, the other thing that, and we've talked a little bit about this, the loss of human life, but there's so many different ways that you know, comes out in terms of, like, you look at, like, having spent some time in many places in Africa and seeing the way that people live and the kinds of things that people are confronted with, and that just even in terms of sanitation and the diseases that are brought down on people in their millions, and what impact is that? Does El Nino have any impact on things like that?
Well, it can. You know, huge changes in the sort of normal weather or the climate that you get do have an impact on viruses and the spread of disease. Of course, water is important for maintaining life. And when rainfall patterns get disrupted in this big a sense, it can really wreak havoc with farming and health consequences as well.
Now, there's something you've done a lot of work, obviously. You don't just sit around and look at the impact of it, but you actually try to understand the phenomenon. Now, it's a natural phenomenon?
It is. El Nino is a natural phenomenon. We've been suffering through them, if you will, for millennia, and we will continue to probably see El Ninos. Now, that doesn't mean that climate change is not also a very real phenomenon and one that we are going to have to deal with very soon.
What's the relationship between El Nino and climate change?
Well, that's a really great question. And to be honest, we don't really know yet. We know that the planet is warming up. We know that sea levels are rising. And we know that people's activity is the cause. But how will that affect the weather? Things like El Nino, these natural climate phenomenon and natural weather phenomenon, have been going on for millennia, and they will probably continue. But climate change could reshape them. You know, we could be looking at more frequent El Ninos. We could be looking at less frequent El Ninos. But we really don't know the answer yet.
Mm-hmm. Is there any, I mean, when I was talking about the relationship too, I was wondering is like there's, you know, look, you can look at global warming and you can, you know, there's a lot of things. And I really, you know, rail at the point about when people are saying, well, you know, just you keep your lights on too long and you're
right,
the problem.
Right.
No, you know, I mean, there's, yes, people are trained to be sort of careless about it. Careless and carefree and care only about certain elements of the things in their life. And it's the climate is not generally one because we're robbed of that opportunity to understand what's really going on. And people like you are actually trying to help us understand
this
thing.
Right. You know, we have built our civilization around the climate we've had for the last 10,000 years. And it's been a very stable, warm, friendly climate to us, despite a few bumps and wiggles. But now we are pushing our planet's climate into an all-new regime and one that is going to change our entire civilization. And so the question is, how far do we want to push it?
And tell me this, what, you know, when you're talking about that, if you, like you said, how far are we going to push it? Do we want to push it? And there's this question of we, that's what I'm really trying to wrestle with this thing of, you know, look, there are certain things you can say that, like, you look at what's going on in Paris, you look at what went on in Copenhagen, and there's this refusal. I mean, and it's just, all right, you know, it's just like, well, it's not that bad. You know, come on, look, it's, you know, and there was some of this, you know, strange science, phony science in a certain sense that was saying, well, look, there's actually, this proves, oh, you're talking about El Nino, you're talking about all this in relation to global warming, and you see, there's a period where it was actually not so hot. Well, it wasn't really not so hot. It was just... it was masked in a certain sense.
Right. I mean, look, there's no doubt that humans are reshaping the planet's climate. The scientific evidence is totally clear. And people who say otherwise are just manipulating the facts. The fact is that humans are warming up the planet. We're driving sea levels higher and higher. I think it's time for us to figure out how to do something about it. It's a tough problem. Don't get me wrong. Our economy for the last 150 years has been built on burning these fossil fuels and switching. You can't just switch. We don't have an easy alternative. So it's a hard problem. I get that. But we have to start figuring out how to address it. And time is definitely running out.
You know, it's interesting, too, because what you're talking about when you're talking about what's actually the constraints that the humanity is faced with, the biggest question that really needs to be, how is humanity going to survive? And part of that has to be in a living relationship with the planet, with the environment. You know,
absolutely. It's sort of a new thing for humans to be able to have this much control over the climate. We're really, in terms of the global climate, we are forcing it more than anything else and really rapidly. You know, this is unlike anything that's been seen in millions of years. So now that we know we're doing it, we have to make a conscious choice about whether we want to do it and how much we want to do it. You know, we like our planet kind of the way it is.
Well, yeah. In terms of the climate. But that's a question. That's really a related issue because, you know, look, the biggest user of oil in the entire world is the U.S. military. All right. And they're not about to say, yo, you know, look, wait, no, back, everybody back up, you know, because they're out there. Look, they keep savaging the planet to get more. You know?
Right.
And that impact of human, and that's human. It's systemic in the terms of the kind of system we live under. But it's also these decisions are actually being made in terms of what are we going to set priorities on? And what worries me a lot is the fact that as long as this society is the way it is, these decisions are going to get made and I'm not saying they would never adjust things, but there's a sure as hell direction that things are going in. And this worrisome, this, you know, when I read that article in the LA Times about El Nino and its impact on the rest of the world, I even smacked myself in the head because it was sort of like, I never considered that. And we're trained that way, you know, we're trained to look at that like that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I like to tell people often ask me about climate change and what they can do. And there's a bunch of things you can do. Of course, you can reduce your own carbon footprint. You can try and drive a fuel-efficient car, et cetera, et cetera. But the most important thing you can do is vote. We have to tell our elected representatives what we want, and we have to make them listen.
Well, then you might get somebody like Barack Obama, who basically tells you to go to hell. I could see, since you told me what your ideas are, I mean, look, I think we need a whole new society, a whole new way that society is structured. You know, and I think revolution is the solution for that, in terms that it can bring in an actual ability to not be constrained by all the need for profit and what's going to impact what, but can actually take a scientific approach to this and unleash people, unleash you to do all the work that right now you scramble around for around for funding. You know, the constraints that might be put on you around this thing I was going to ask you about, and this will have to be close to wrapping up. But, you know, this point around, what is it called now? It's called, and it's something that is your baby, man, all right? It's called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation.
Right.
No idea what it is, but the fact that if you could be unleashed in terms of the importance of working on this and solving this and finding the ways to work with people all like yourself all over the world, and the only thing that stops it is the flow of money and the flow and the need, the paying attention to it, you know, to the need for this, that's the kind of world we need, is one where you aren't constrained like that.
Well, I should say that I've had great opportunities to work as a scientist, and I love doing it, and I'm happy for those opportunities. But I do agree that we need a certain amount of change, and it's been really tough to bring it about. But I think we have to keep trying. You know, I'm not ready to rip the system down, but I think that we do have to.
Well, we'll keep talking, Josh. We'll keep talking. Are you going to be back on the show many times? Because I really like what we're talking about here. But when you talked about, there's things that we can, that, you know, you're saying that you keep trying, you're doing certain things, and you said that there's certain constraints. What actually, in your view right now, what is— Well, you still haven't answered this. What's the Pacific?
What's the Pacific Decadal Oscillation?
Yeah, that's going to be our last question. Right. What is it?
All right. The Pacific Decadal Oscillation is sort of like El Nino's bigger, slower moving brother.
All right. That's what my brother says about me. Okay.
it's very much like an El Nino, but it changes over 20 or 30 years, and it tends to bring either warm, dry conditions or cold, wet. It tends to either bring wet or dry conditions to Southern California and the Western United States.
Mm-hmm. All right, Josh Willis, we're going to have to cut it off now, but I really definitely want you back, man. All
fantastic. Right, really fun to be here.
Yeah, great, man. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Josh Willis, climatologist and oceanographer with NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory out in Pasadena, and we're talking about El Nino, what it is, the impact it may have on people around the world, and why you should give a damn and pay attention to this stuff. We're going to, Teddy, let's play this next song. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back.
I see the orphans on the streets of Afghanistan. I see the bones of the drones of Tajikistan. I see disease on their knees in Uzbekistan. I think we need a plan. Why do you silence the speech? I'm getting agitated. You stop to turn up the heat. I will not be dissuaded. I see the light shining.
All right, welcome back. And that is Conspiracy of Thought with The Plan, all right? And now we're going to bring on another blockbuster, all right? We're going to bring on another blockbuster. Joining us now is Larry Everest, writer for Revolution Newspaper, RevCom.us, and author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. And we're going to talk about, in the wake of San Bernardino, why things like this happen, what should we be doing about it, and why we should definitely not be rooting for our own rulers, all right? So let's do this, okay? Larry, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael, good to be with you.
Yeah, good to have you here, man. Let's jump into this. In the wake of the horrible killings, as I was saying, so many innocent people in San Bernardino, the system has gone hog wild in attempting to whip up a very ugly climate broadly among the people. Let's talk about this. What the hell are they doing? Where's it coming from? What are they doing?
Well, first of all, I mean, the murders in San Bernardino, 14 people killed, 21 injured, people from all walks of life. I mean, this was a horrific outrage and completely unjustifiable. No possible justification for this. But here's the problem. This system has jumped on this incident to try to really train people to look at the whole world through a warped, xenophobic, chauvinist, imperialist viewpoint, and to try to build further support for their repression and war. you can obviously, there's Trump and these, yes, fascistic calls of his to ban Muslim immigrants and all the racist and xenophobic hatred that's being whipped up and that's led to increased attacks against Muslims in this country, which are completely outrageous. But look, this isn't just Trump. It's, for one, most of the Republican Party, but it's also the entire ruling class that's, whatever their differences about precisely how to run the empire, and those differences are very deep, all of them have jumped onto this basic bandwagon of training people in this outlook. I mean, look at the media coverage that you were mentioning of the San Bernardino massacre. This was wall-to-wall. Compare this to the coverage of the November 27th massacre at the Planned Parenthood in Colorado. Was there wall-to-wall coverage of this that made the connection between the murder and the whole right-wing anti-woman, anti-abortion movement that seeks to enslave women, including using this kind of violence? No, it wasn't. And you know, and again, this wasn't any kind of wall-to-wall coverage, and that shows you something right there. I think you can also take Obama's speech as another. I mean, people were talking, you know, the liberal media was talking about this as a reassuring speech and so on. This was a war speech. This was a speech aiming to enlist people in and to justify the U.S.'s ongoing war that, yes, is directed against reactionary jihadist forces like ISIS, who do commit terrible crimes. But this, on the part of the U.S., this is essentially a war of empire that's designed to maintain and enforce a whole system of global exploitation that grinds up billions of lives and, as you were talking about in your last segment, is threatening the very existence of life on planet Earth. And this war has involved killing and terrorizing literally millions of people. I mean, there was a recent study that U.S. wars in just Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq have been responsible for 1.3 million deaths. And this is a war that Obama's vowing to continue. And by the way, in his speech, he is also vowing to step up repression, including against Muslims and the targeting of Muslims. So this is not something, this is something that we should reject, this whole effort by the rulers of this country.
You know, one thing, Larry, as you're speaking, I can't help but think and keep coming back on this about actually this whole idea when we were talking about what are they actually trying to bring forward here? What are they actually trying to gel and coalesce and make into a bigger force in society? And it's right. You talk about, you know, there's Trump and all the fascistic stuff that he comes out with. But then this whole thing of the then there's the Republican Party, but then there's the system itself in terms of, yeah, it's like there's the Republicans, but then there's the whole system and the whole system and all of them in it where they have some differences. They all are facing a pretty heavy situation right now, and they really are straining the limits to try and really mold the way people think and perceive the world and conceive of what to do in the world, which is all going to be coming from, we are the good guys, they are the bad people. And it's sort of like, and it's on us to save the world for, and it's very, very heavy because when people do that, they are jumping into bed with a monster.
Well, exactly right. And I mean, in this context, I really think that this point Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, makes about what is the dynamic that we're actually looking at here that has been deepening over the last 14 years, really. And what he calls this, what he argues that this clash between jihad and Mac world, Mac crusade, or jihad and imperialism, is a clash between historically outmoded strata among colonized and oppressed humanity, people like people in the Middle East, you know, like these countries in the Middle East, up against historically outmoded ruling strata of the imperialist system. These two reactionary poles reinforce each other even while opposing each other. If you side with either of these outmodeds, you end up strengthening both. I mean, this is just extremely important. And just think about the last 14 years and how they've borne out exactly what Avakian is pointing to here. And he goes on to say that understanding this dynamic, we also have to be clear about which of these outmoded has done the far greater damage to humanity and poses a far greater threat. And again, and not only by war, but also by climate change and many other ways. And that's the U.S. imperialists and the imperialist system. That's the far greater danger. And he goes on to make the point that actually these Islamist fundamentalist forces would be largely dormant if not for the for the actions of imperialism. I mean, this is something I think is so important for people to wrestle with, because how have we gotten to the place that we've gotten? And Avakian is describing that dynamic. And one thing it really points to, and you're making this point, is this isn't any time to rally behind the empire, whether the Democrats or the Republicans, and accept that we have to choose either imperialism or Islamic fundamentalism, that these are the only choices. And one element of breaking out of this whole dynamic is for people in this country to consciously and visibly take up the viewpoint that humanity comes first, and to consciously and visibly oppose U.S. xenophobic attacks on people from other countries living here, on Muslims living here, and also visibly oppose all the different forms of U.S. war moves, whether it's sending more troops into Iraq and Syria, whether it's these drone strikes, whatever it may be. This is a very important thing to help break out of this cycle.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Larry Everest, writer for Revolution Newspaper, RevCom.us, and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. All right, Larry, we got about 6 minutes left, and I want to ask you a couple of questions here. One, you made this point about if you side with one of these outmoded forces that Avakian talks about, then you're also siding with the other as well, right? And, you know, you're helping to basically help each of them flourish. So tell people why, you know, the big question there for a lot of people, I think, and I think it needs to be explained a little bit more, why is that?
Well, look, I mean, there are a lot of there are different dimensions to this. One dimension is that the U.S. is often directly supported, when it suits their interests, reactionary jihadist forces, whether we're talking about Afghanistan in the 1980s or the support Saudi Arabia, a key U.S. ally, has given to jihadist forces, including ISIS in Iraq and Syria. And, you know, you can go online and find all this at RevCom. But the other thing, the other element is, of course, when you're raining death and destruction down on people in the Middle East, for example, people look to anyone who's fighting against this. And in that way, this strengthens Islamic jihadism in that way. But I think the most and to the degree there's silence and complicity in this country, that also convinces people that there's no real alternative. But I think the most important thing for people to understand is that there is actually a viable and visionary alternative to this. And there's actually a real prospect of making revolution in this country. And this is based on the work done by Bob Avakian over decades to bring forward a viable and a visionary new synthesis of communism, and the strategy and leadership to get to that different and far better world. And I think this is absolutely crucial, because one of the things that has perpetuated this cycle is this notion that there isn't an alternative. And it's really incumbent on people who want to see a different world without imperialism, without reactionary fundamentalism, to get into Avakian's work and learn about this, the strategy for revolution here, and this new synthesis of communism. And of course, you can find that at revcom.us. I'd encourage people to read this new book by Ardea Skybreak called Science and Revolution. It was a very interesting book on the importance of science, the application of science to society, and the new synthesis of communism, the leadership of Bob Avakian. Very interesting. And Avakian has also written an outline of the fundamental orientation, method, and approach and core elements of this new synthesis, which is another very accessible thing people can find on at revcom.s. But, you know, I think all of these things that are taking place, all the contradictions this system is up against, are not a sign of strength. And it really is an important part of getting to a different world, to oppose the crimes of this system, these wars of aggression, these occupations, and to break out of this horrific cycle that much of the world finds itself caught up in.
All right, let me ask you one more question and then we'll wrap it up. And you have a few minutes, you can go on this. In your piece that you talked about earlier about we shouldn't root for our own rulers and it's better that they lose their wars, that's something that it's not just a sentiment there. There's actually, I was thinking about how that fits in with, in opposition to the whole way that what we started this conversation out with, of the way that people are being trained to view the world and trained to react to things and analyze things and what they're being trained to do. And there's a lot, there was a piece in RevCom that I was reading that talked about how one of the things that's really critical for people right now is to also begin operating from the standpoint of humanity, not from the standpoint of this or that, the U.S. or anything else, or the Islamic Jihad or whatever. You know, this is this kind of thing that actually trained people to actually look at things from the standpoint of all of humanity and where it needs to go. And I wanted to talk about that because you wrote a very good piece, a very powerful piece about why it's better if they, not just not siding with them, not just not rooting for our rulers, but why it's better if they lose their wars. And that requires that you look at the world in a whole different way.
Well, it does. And of course, every time there's wall-to-wall coverage of horrific things that happen to people living in this country, I think to myself, where's the wall-to-wall coverage of the 130 people in Yemen who were attending a wedding and massacred by a U.S.-backed and U.S.-armed Saudi Arabia? Why don't we hear that? Why don't we see the humanity and the suffering and the pain and the tears of those people? Well, we never do because, again, as you're saying, we're being consciously and deliberately trained into thinking only American lives count. And so what if the U.S. goes and mass murders thousands of people? This is never, ever talked about. But I think the point about not rooting for the U.S. and it's better if they lose, I mean, just think about it. As we've talked about, these are wars of empire designed to strengthen oppression, wars that have fueled reactionary fundamentalism. Why is it a good thing if those wars succeed so that the misery and the environmental destruction caused by imperialism go on and on? No. So that there are more Islamic jihadists created by the day? No. So why is it? There's nothing good coming from a U.S. quote-unquote victory. In fact, when the U.S. has been defeated in places like Vietnam and Iraq, it's inhibited their ability to do this. And of course, from the standpoint of revolutionaries, this does not mean you're hoping that jihadists who are reactionaries and have nothing to offer humanity at all are being supported, or that we hope they win either. The point is to support and strengthen communists, revolutionaries in every country, and people in every country who are opposing both of these reactionary and outmoded forces. And, you know, from a revolutionary standpoint, we're doing part of this is getting to a whole better world. And right now in this country, preparing the ground, preparing the people, and preparing the vanguard, the Revolutionary Communist Party, and getting ready for a time when millions can be led to go for an actual revolution with all out, with a real chance to win. And this is what we need to do to really end these horrors.
All right, Larry, we're going to have to wrap it up with that. And thank you very much for joining us today, man.
Hey, well, always great to be with you, Mark.
Yeah, well, we need to have you back more often and sooner, all right? So get in line.
Well, you have my phone number, brother.
All right, Larry, take care, man. Thanks
a
lot.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Larry Everest. Larry is a journalist and writer with Revcom.us and Revolution Newspaper. He's also the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. And we were talking about, in the wake of the terrible, terrible murders in San Bernardino, what this system is trying to do and what it basically requires from the people in terms of a response. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was World Upside Down from Jimmy Cliff, and the album is Rebirth. All right, and we've got a special treat for this segment of the show today. I recently had a chance to speak with the attorney, Gary Blasi. He's an attorney who fights for the rights of homeless, among many other things. And one of the things he's been doing is been laying bare what's happening to the homeless people and what is going to happen to them in the face of El Nino, the coming El Nino. And Gary's wrote a pretty powerful op-ed piece in the Los Angeles Times. And I thought it'd be important for people all over the country to hear this, because what's going on in L.A. is an example of what this society does to people at the very bottom of the society, what it does and what it doesn't do, all right? And it's worthwhile. And you can learn a lot from what Gary reveals about the homeless and the plans for the homeless in the face of El Nino. So without any further ado, check out this interview I did with Gary just a couple of days ago. All right, we have been talking about El Nino, and it's for the last little bit of time, we've been talking about the impact of it and how it's nothing to be fooling around with or laughing about or joking about, even though, you know, people, and I know people are sitting there and saying, you know, well, look, there's going to be a lot of it's going to bring snowfall to the ski resorts. It's going to bring rain that might help end the drought, things that are true. At the same time, this is predicted by many scientists to be the worst El Nino event in history. And it is going to have a severe impact on a population of people that way too much is either ignored or just repressed and sort of pretended that they're not there. And that's the homeless people in Los Angeles. And here to talk with us about this is Gary Blasi. Gary's been on a show before, but I was really interested in talking with him again after reading an op-ed piece he did in the LA Times. And Gary is a professor of law emeritus at UCLA, and he's a special counsel with the Public Counsel's Opportunity Under Law Initiative. Gary, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
Let's jump into this. El Nino is coming, as I said, and it's not going to be easy for one particular group of people. I mean, it could cause a lot of damage across the board, but there's one particular group of people that never seems to be sort of in the picture when people are talking about the impact of this, and that's the homeless. Why don't you tell us about that? You've done a lot of investigation. You have a lot of thoughts on that.
Sure. So I've been working with homeless people, including people in street encampments, for a long time. The problem with the way in which the city and the county and policymakers and charity and everyone else has been dealing with this homeless issue is that they're dealing with it at the proverbial 30,000 feet, or in some cases the 5,000 foot level. But where it really matters is at the 3-inch level, which is that when you get wet and you get cold, you die. That's just a fact of nature. And you don't have to be very cold when you're wet to die of hypothermia or to experience hypothermia. And if you don't get treated while that's happening, it doesn't take that long to pass away. So that, I think, is a real concern. The winter may not be colder than usual, but it's absolutely guaranteed to be wetter than usual. And so it's keeping people dry while they're forced to live on the street, that is a real challenge. And it's a shame that we have to talk about dealing with homelessness in terms of putting people up on pallets or getting them above the runoff or providing extra tarps and that sort of thing. But that's unfortunately where we are. That's the kind of emergency we're actually in, which is different than the public relations declaration of emergency that was issued back in September.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that a little bit later in the interview, but that's a really important point, actually, that it is different than what actually has been done or not done here now. One thing I'd like to know is, what's the size of the people that are in danger?
There are in Los Angeles, in the city, about 18,000 people sleeping outdoors. Los Angeles has the second most homeless people in the country after New York, but it has by far the most people who are sleeping with no shelter at all. Los Angeles is only able to provide temporary overnight shelter to 30% of the homeless population, compared to New York's 95%, or even Houston's 67%. So we are by far the worst major city in terms of having so many people exposed to the elements.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing just that sort of struck me as I was reading about this in preparation for the interview, you're talking about mainly, and what you've been dealing with is the people that are living on the sidewalks and the streets. There's also a whole significant section of people here in L.A., and I don't know if it's peculiar to L.A. or not because of the geography, but there's a lot of people that live in the parks or in the riverside and different places like that, that they're already living exposed to the elements in a big way. And it would seem that something like with El Nino, if people are forced to stay in those areas, that could be devastating.
Well, I think that's right. I think it's one thing to be on a sidewalk or under an overpass. Overpass might provide a little protection from the rain, but not from the runoff. But we do have a lot of people that have been basically forced by law enforcement to get out of view. And the one place you can get out of view is up in the Arroyo and up in the canyons. I live near Griffith Park. We have a fairly substantial homeless population in the park, and they're always down in the valleys. They're not on the hilltops for obvious reasons. And so if you get a lot of runoff, then they're going to have much more serious problems, certainly getting wet, but also just drowning in the runoff. I think that's a serious concern. And those folks have to be given some option to get to higher ground, to more stable ground.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were talking about people, you know, that being a result of, some of it being the result of policing and how it's carried out against the homeless in the city, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Los Angeles has had a policy and a law on the books for a long time that it's illegal to be on the sidewalk under a federal court settlement between the hours of 6 a.m. and 9 p.m. And so fairly routinely now, despite the mayor's talk about a moratorium, the police officers are arresting people at 6:15 a.m. because they haven't taken their tents down. And there's nothing in that law or that settlement that says it makes a difference whether it's pouring rain or not. So it's hard for me to imagine that there are actually uniformed officers who are going to be telling people in the middle of a downpour, you've got to get out of that tent and expose yourself to this rain. But that's what the law is, and worse things have happened, frankly. So that is a serious concern. And as that law enforcement pressure has hit places. Originally, it was really focused on Skid Row, but now it's focused basically wherever the local politicians are asking LAPD to do something. And so it's forced people further and further back into the rough country. So, as I say, it's one thing to be on concrete. It's quite another to be on mud or in a wash where the runoff is going to be.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Gary Blasi. Gary's a professor of law emeritus at UCLA and special counsel with Public Counsel's Opportunity Under Law Initiative. And we're talking about the threat to the homeless population of Los Angeles in the coming El Nino, predicted by many scientists to be the worst in history. Now, you also have talked about that, and you started to talk about this earlier. You talked about what it's going to take would actually be a declaration of a state of emergency. Can you talk about that and the difference between that and this, you know, what they have declared here in L.A., the state of emergency, the declaration of a state of emergency,
right,
and what that's going to entail?
So what we have had routinely for a long time is called a declaration of a shelter crisis. And what that does is make it possible for the city to allocate resources for overnight shelter. And so we have what's called the winter shelter program. Runs from November to March, and they've extended it a little bit this year. And that program is full all the time, but it's not a very good option for most people, because if you're on the street, in order to access that overnight shelter, you've got to basically give up everything you have. Some of them say you can bring a small bag or 2 cubic feet of something. You can't bring a pet, you can't bring a friend if you're trying to stay with someone. And worse yet, all you get is a place for the night, and then you're back on the street, raining or not. And then you've got to line up and go through that entire process again the next night. It's not like you get in and then they say, well, you can have this bed for a week. You have that bed for the next 8 or 9 hours, and then you're back on the street. So that's what we get under a shelter crisis declaration. Under that declaration, the mayor could also designate public buildings to be used as temporary shelter. What you get with a declaration of local emergency is you get basically the cutting of red tape and putting the authority in the hands of the mayor to take immediate action. So, for example, if the mayor decided that the 18,000 homeless people on the streets of L.A., that 10,000 of them needed some tarps, he would not have to go through a whole budgeting process and go through several motions in the city council. He's authorized under the city's code and charter to requisition supplies and then put the city's credit behind that requisition, and to do that on an urgent basis. I mean, the emergency declaration wasn't designed specifically with homelessness in mind, but it was designed with the notion that sometimes you have to act quickly. And that's what neither the city nor the county has done. So they're basically currently facing these issues, thinking that they're going to go through the regular legislative process. And while they're doing that, while they're talking and blowing hot air, a lot of people are going to be dying to the very cold air.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had said before that, you know, it's sort of like, what difference would it make to people, though, in terms of them being able to live? I mean, sometimes it's hard, I think, for people to understand what difference it makes to have actually tarps and to have these. You know, I was talking to somebody the other night who was homeless and who was like talking about how frigid they get at nights. And they were looking for to borrow a coat to just cover them up at night for this. And it's hard for people who aren't experienced with this or haven't had any contact with homeless people to understand what difference it would make to have something like this going on.
Well, as I say, it can make the difference between life and death, and it can certainly make the difference between staying, there are very few people who are very healthy who are living on the street, but the difference between going from just sick and becoming extremely ill and ending up in an emergency room, it can make that much difference. And, you know, I think middle-class, working-class people who have, you know, camped and that sort of thing, they have a sense of what it's like when you have equipment designed for this. This isn't the case where, although homeless people now often have access to tents, they're usually shabby old tents and they leak. And the kinds of clothing and warmth-providing materials they have are nothing like you're gonna have if you're a middle-class camper. People have whatever they can find or whatever is available, and there's nobody giving away waterproof parkas or Gore-Tex. That just doesn't happen.
Now let's look at this. What exactly has the city done in terms of being able to, the kind of money that they've spent, what the kind of resources that they put in this, what is going to be available for homeless people coming into this?
Well, right now there's extremely little that's relevant at all to deal with these immediate issues. The mayor has allocated $12 million, reallocated $12 million to do a variety of things, but none of those things have any particular payoff. So, for example, he's wants to add another couple of million dollars to the intake system for the shelter program, which is called the Coordinated Entry System. But the problem is not that people have a really hard time filling out applications. It's that all those shelters are full. So having a Cracker Jack entry room, it's sort of like going into the waiting room of a doctor, and then they call you back, and the door opens onto an alley rather than a doctor's office. So it's not the front end that's the problem, it's the back end. And on the back end, actually providing housing, temporary housing, shelter, anything, there's virtually nothing happening. So that's why we're sort of reduced, you know, in this argument to saying, let's keep people alive until we can deal with this longer-term problem.
Now, the city... Go ahead.
So I was going to say, you know, they're talking now about having, the city and the county are talking about coming out with their grand strategy in February, which will be, by the time that gets wrapped up, El Nino will be over and we'll have a body count. So that's fine if they have a long-term plan, but I think as Kane said, you know, in the long run, we're all dead. And in this case, homeless people, it's not such the long run.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing here, too, that the city apparently at one point announced that now they talked about they were going to declare a state of emergency, and they didn't do that, but they did declare what you had talked about, which is this shelter. What is it called? The shelter?
The shelter crisis. They've done that routinely every year for the past decade or so. That's really that's really completely routine. And the only consequence of that is it allows them to run this winter shelter program using National Guard armories and so on.
Right. Now, the other thing that they said, and I read your response, which I thought was really good. They said that they also were setting aside $100 million, and you said kind of like straight up, bull.
Yeah, there is no $100 million. What that translated to was the mayor asked the chief administrative officer to go into the city budget and see if he could find $100 million. It's sort of like, you know, saying that you have this new source of funds, and it's that you're going to go look in your couch cushions. So basically, the CAO dug around in the couch cushions of the city bureaucracy, and he found a little bit of money, which all has to be reallocated. But there is no $100 million. And, you know, all the to-do about the state of emergency and the $100 million, that was actually international news back in September 22nd, when that was announced. But to date, there is no state of emergency, and there is no $100 million. There is nothing now that there was not in September. There have been meetings and talk, and thus far, there's been nothing but meetings and talk.
Mm-hmm. Now, just one more question, and that is, and in your op-ed piece, I read where you said that the L.A. spends $13 million a year on the homeless, and that amounts to 1 cent, 1 penny per day. That's a pretty brutal thing going on.
That's pretty brutal. What's even more brutal is that the city actually does already spend $100 million a year. There's that $13 million you mentioned, but there's $87 million that goes to the police just for the purpose of policing homeless people. So if we just took the $87 million that's currently allocated to LAPD for overtime and such to deal with this issue, and started using it in a positive way, that right there would be the $100 million. But, of course, that would mean moving money from the LAPD budget to some other budget, and that is not going to happen in this city with these politics.
Mm-hmm. All right, Gary Blasi, thank you very much for joining us today.
Good to be here.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Gary Blasi. Gary's a professor of law emeritus at UCLA, and he's a special counsel with Public Counsel's Opportunity Under Law Initiative. And we've been talking about the brutal impact of El Nino on the homeless and what the hell is being done to prevent that, to prevent actually death for quite a few people, death and intense suffering. That brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests for today. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my intern, Alex Brenner, and my board op for today, Teddy Robinson. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with War Poem from UB40.
Silence falls in no man's land to echo on uncertain steps. Sharp of eye and quick of hand, advancing forward to